And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Formula One is back this weekend with hostilities resuming at the Belgian Grand Prix. But how will the rule changes impacting the floor affect the competitive order, and what should we expect from the revised Spa circuit in what could be its last Grand Prix for a while? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer those questions and many more are Mark Hughes and Ben Anderson. Well, Mark, back to reality after your summer off, presumably a leisurely few weeks.
Portuguese time, and very much that sort of tempo as well. So, back to normal speed now.
Excellent. Got the idea that Portugal just moves a lot slower. Is that the general feeling?
Well, in that sort of heat, it's only right, isn't it? Things start a bit later and don't move quite as fast.
We'll get our Portuguese listeners complaining. All the Pedro Lamy fans will be out in force to push back. And Ben Anderson, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. I was in Canada recently, so that was my tactic for avoiding the UK heat wave.
Yeah, that was quite a good trick. How's the pace of life in Canada?
Well, the pace of life on my holiday, probably quite similar to Mark's, slow. But I mean, with kids in tow, you can't get the same kind of leisurely start. It's all early start and early finish. Well, early start and late finish, actually.
Excellent. So back to work is actually the relaxation for you. That's
absolutely. Yeah, I'm serene now.
Excellent. Well, that's what we need in a podcast. Nice, serene performance from you. Let's delve straight into it. And Mark, one of the big talking points is going to be the rule changes the FIA has introduced to prevent liberties being taken with the plank and skid flexibility. Of course, nobody's doing that, as they all do point out at great length. So can you explain what's changing for Spa and the potential impact?
So for Spa, which was originally for France but postponed, the interpretation of the regs concerning the plank mounting has been tightened up. So when the FIA began to devise this tech directive post-Baku, we remember Baku, the porpoising was extreme on several cars. So they came up with this TD after that to limit the porpoising, and it found... The FIA found it wasn't as simple as it had assumed. It was originally simply going to put a limit on the force of the vertical accelerations on the car, but it found, as it looked more deeply into it, that Red Bull and Ferrari were using a different interpretation of mounting the plank than the others. They'd been able to do it in a way which created space between the plank and the floor, which allowed the plank to effectively sink in towards the floor when it hit the ground, given better resistance to bouncing, but also potentially allowing those cars to run a lower rear ride height by maybe 5 or 6 millimetres, which typically would be worth around 2 or 3 tenths of lap time. So in order to make the playing field level for the lateral acceleration TD, the FIA decided all teams must adhere to the same interpretation of plank flexibility, and that used by everyone else and not the Red Bull Ferrari interpretation. So that's what comes into effect this weekend for the first time. So if it really is 2 or 3 tenths, that's probably not going to be enough to change the competitive order by itself, but it should allow the others, probably led by Mercedes, to be that much closer. I know Merck set pole position last time out in Hungary, but it was circumstantial. Neither Red Bull was contesting it, and Ferrari were miles out of the tyre window. So we saw, you know, on race day, effectively, it was still around half a second off the pace, which is a lot closer than it had been earlier in the season. But if this changes in the order of 2 or 3 tenths, then, you know, it brings them that much closer and perhaps gives them a chance to get involved and put a little bit more pressure on. But I don't see it automatically making them on Ferrari Red Bull pace just from the regulation change itself.
It's often the way with these technical regulation changes or these technical directives mid-season that there's lots and lots of talk about them, and then they do have a bit of an impact, but they never fundamentally change it, do they? Never make the slowest car quickest or anything, or even transform things. But do you have high hopes, Ben, for it being a little bit closer up front?
Yeah, you'd like to think so. I mean, it's likely, obviously, to affect both of those teams, but at the same time, you know, they've had some sight of this, so you would imagine that Ferrari and Red Bull would make some adjustments to try and recapture a bit of the lap time. It's not that they're going to automatically just fall back into the clutches of everybody else. And then also, you know, Mercedes, as Mark mentioned, competitive in Hungary, but a lot of that was circumstantial. And although the car's improving, now we go to Spa, which has very particular setup compromises. They've got a very draggy car as well, Mercedes. So I don't think it's automatically going to suddenly be this dream, like three-way fight at the front that everybody wants. But sure, it's going to help Mercedes a little bit. But they've got bigger problems than this, I think.
One of the things, Mark, that has been a talking point in the past few races as well has been the 23 changes. Those have been ratified now. We've got a 15-millimetre raising of the floor edges rather than the proposed 25 millimetres. Do you think everybody's just going to keep quiet about that now and get on with it? Or do you think there'll still be a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing in the paddock as everyone plays the political game?
I think most of horse trading's probably done now. I think most of the campaigning was being done just before the summer break when the change was going to be in the order of 25 millimetres. And I think the change to 15 that you've just mentioned is a result of that campaigning. And the idea is that it's just to make the aerodynamics a bit less peaky, a bit more benign. You wouldn't imagine going to fundamentally affect the whole concept of a team's new car, which is sort of what was being hinted at pre the summer break.
Yeah, there was lots of complaints about costs and dramatically different chassis design and all sorts. But as always, these things are a little bit overblown when it comes to playing the political game, but probably a sensible direction for everyone to go in. But Ben, Spa, it's the start of a run of 9 races at the back end of this season. It was very front-loaded with 13 races already done. Max Verstappen has an 80-point lead over Charles Leclerc in the Drivers' Championship and Red Bull's 97 points clearing the Constructors' Championship. So it's fair to say it's going to take something extraordinary for them not to win the title. So if there's no championship fight, what's really at stake other than just a bunch of race wins?
well, the championship is still at stake, theoretically. But, I mean, yeah, as you say, it's a... It almost seems like a foregone conclusion now, especially the way Red Bull and Max in particular are operating. You know, they've gotten stronger as the season's progressed. Ferrari are just shambolic. I mean, you know, you guys and we have talked about this kind of endlessly pre-summer break, that they just seem to be able to find new ways to throw away their pace advantage, lose races from winning positions. So really what's at stake beyond the confirmation of the championships, if you like, is can Ferrari transform themselves into a proper winning operation that looks like it might have a proper chance next year? Maybe if some of the pressure of actually being in the hunt is removed, they might be able to react better, focus on these problems and find solutions before next year gets going. I'd like to see them execute races more consistently and at least put up a fight and make Red Bull work as hard as possible for it. And then also there's the Mercedes factor. You know, how much more can they improve? How much longer are they going to stick with this zero pod concept and keep developing that in leading up to next year's car? Can they close the gap and start to challenge for race wins genuinely? Obviously, we talked about the new metrics and whether that will make a difference. You know, that is something that remains to be seen. And also there's the small matter of best of the rest in the Constructors' Championship, McLaren versus Alpine. That's a very tight fight. Who's going to get the edge in that? It looks like Alpine have the better race car. McLaren have the faster qualifier in Lando Norris and an underperforming second car. So, yeah, in that tight contest, who's going to get the best over the final 9 races and secure fourth?
That's the grudge match with the battle over Oscar Piastri services as well. So that'll be a lively battle. But Mark, in terms of Ferrari, we've talked so much on this podcast this year about Ferrari not delivering on their ultimate potential. Is there reason to expect much of a shift in that? Do you think that despite Mattia Binotto's best protestations, they are probably working quite hard to try and tighten up on this kind of thing, make sure the strategy calls are correct and ensure that the reliability is tightened up?
You would hope that at least internally that the recognition of the problems are there. And even though it's quite understandable that he doesn't want to publicly start laying out the reasons for it. The pity of it is that they've ticked off two of the really intractable hard problems, just the raw speed and the working environment, which was always previously, you know, an environment of fear. So that he's got a really nice working environment there. He's got the technical department working beautifully in terms of producing a very, very fast car with a lot of its own innovations. But now they need to address the reliability and that line of recognition and response to those underlying problems that you talked about, just strategy calls, etc. So, yeah, I think there's still a lot to be done, and I don't think it's the work of I think we've said before, it's not the work of just a rethink over the summer break, but it's a culture thing, and you would hope that it's happening internally. But it is. The two really difficult bits have been done, and that's what makes it extra frustrating.
Yeah, they've very much gone their own way with the car concept. Everybody, when the car launched, thought, that looks a little bit odd. How's that going to work? And it's worked really, really, really well. They have had the quickest car on average over the season, particularly strong in qualifying. Race day, sometimes a bit harder, but should have won a lot more races. But on the driver front, Ben, how do you see the Leclerc-Sainz situation? Because Sainz started not badly as such, but he was struggling with the car. There were a couple of bad weekends at Imola and Australia, and he fell well behind, but then he's picked up some momentum, and Leclerc has had a couple of high-profile errors, but generally has been the lead driver. Do you think that's a subplot for the rest of the season to keep an eye on, or do you think it'll be kind of what we've seen, where it's mainly going Leclerc's way?
No, potentially it is. I mean, there was a pattern last season where, you know, Sainz got stronger as the season progressed, and I think like the final part of the season, didn't he out-qualify Leclerc 5 races out of 6 or something like that? It was certainly more often than not. So I think that's why he was so surprised, taken aback at the start of this year to be as off as he felt he was. But he, you know, he's done what Sainz does, which is dig deep, put the hours in on the sim, work on himself, work on his driving, start to kind of modify his technique. You know, he's a very adaptable driver. And starting to bear fruit for him now. You'd like to think that process can continue. It's important for Ferrari that it does. And it's a testament to Sainz's application that he's been able to make these gains, because obviously the cars have been developing, and we've seen with Sergio Perez, who started the season strongly, how he's slipped back as Red Bull have made progress with their own car. And the other factor, of course, is that Leclerc himself, you know, can he rebound from the recent disappointments? Will he still be all there mentally for the final push, you know, chasing those race wins? You'd imagine he would be, but you know, if he's distracted by Ferrari's shambling around on strategy and a bit discontented with the way everything is going, which it has looked to be the case a little bit in some of his, you know, immediate reactions, there's been a concerted effort by Ferrari to keep a lid on things publicly. And as Mark says, you hope behind the scenes they're actually acknowledging these problems and doing something about them. We can't be sure of that. But Leclerc needs to keep his head in the game. He needs to stay focused. And if he isn't or doesn't, then you could see Sainz, you know, taking the fight to him there and assuming more of a leadership role.
How impressed have you been with Sainz's fight back, Mark? Because we know how hardworking a driver he is, how he is able to get on top of a car, but the circumstances of the first part of the season were really bad, weren't they? First chance in a championship winning car, and he was pretty much out of championship contention within a few races. So is it pretty much what you expected from him, or do you think he's shown an even greater level of his normal fortitude to have bounced back from that?
I think, as Ben said, that's what he does. He's very analytical of himself, and he's very analytical about the car and therefore good at explaining what it is he needs. But I think this is the first time he's come up against a teammate of this caliber at the absolute top of his game. And you know, I think Lando Norris is a fantastic driver and potentially on that similar sort of level. But when he was when he was Sainz's teammate, he was a rookie in the first, second, third season. But this is an absolute one of the great drivers at his peak in a car that's perfectly suited to him, that he's going up against, that he's being measured against. And I think it's just a tough ask. And this year's car, I think, particularly well suited to someone as at ease with pushing the envelope with an oversteery car as Leclerc is. And it's just, made a gap appear that the start of the season that wasn't there last year.
And we can be absolutely sure going into the second half of the season that Sainz will be determined to try and build on that significantly to set himself up for next year. He's not the kind of character who will ease off in any way, so he'll want to have as convincing an end to the season so he can go into next year something approaching an even footing with Leclerc. I think he's always seen in that team as being, by a narrow margin, the second driver just because of that incredible speed Leclerc's got. But Sainz is going to do everything he can to reverse that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, Ben, there have been some changes made at Spa, notably to the Eau Rouge Radeon section. How much difference do you think that'll actually make?
I'm not sure it'll make a massive difference. Pirelli's Mario Solo was talking about being a very dramatic change from the tyre supplier's point of view. Obviously, there's been some resurfacing around the circuit, so that's the kind of thing that's going to get his juices flowing and make some kind of difference. But obviously, the changes are mostly runoffs, an effort to improve safety. There's obviously been some, fairly nasty accidents in recent years through that section, which is obviously blind as you come over the hill very fast. And it is quite dangerous if cars rebound off the barriers back into the path of other cars at those speeds. So hopefully these changes have addressed that. Sight lines will be slightly different. There's gravel down in new places and some different routes that have been put down, particularly at the no-named left-hander. That looks a bit different now. So that will look odd, I think, to drivers when they hit the track for the first time, but it's not something that they'll, be unduly bothered about, and they will quickly adapt, I'm sure. I don't think it's going to make a huge difference to how the cars perform. Eau Rouge Radeon looks just about as fast as before. Maybe it's slightly slow for GT cars, which makes a lot of sense, but I think cars at Formula One level with their grip, it's not going to make any difference really to them. I think the biggest impact of the changes is likely to be felt off track, actually. A lot of this is about kind of modernizing Spa as an F1 venue, fitting with Liberty's drive to Americanize Formula One and put the fan experience more at the heart of things. Difficult for Spa because, the topography there is limiting, the roads in are limiting. It's a very old school, camping style race. How much can you transform that into a Zandvoort beach music party festival? I don't know. But they've certainly made a big investment. And you'd like to think, especially given how we all feel about Spa and the drivers as well, it's such a great circuit, such a brilliant challenge still. It'd be terrible if it dropped off the calendar. So you'd like to think that, the changes they make, and Liberty likes what it sees from the event this weekend, and there's a future there. I think it would be a real shame if there wasn't.
And of course, it looks like it's going to go to every other year, potentially not on next year's calendar, but might be back the year after. But Mark, the main thing we have to hope is that we get a race there this year after after what happened last year. There is meant to be a little bit of rain forecast, but it doesn't look like it's going to be quite the weather we encountered in 2021. So hopeful that Spa can regain some of that lustre after last year's frankly embarrassing farrago.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really Spa's fault at what happened last year, although it's obviously always going to be susceptible to something like that, such are the extremes of weather that you can get in that little microclimate. But really magnificent circuit, and I think even with these changes, it'll still be an extreme challenge, maybe even more so, actually. And it seems ridiculous that we should be talking about whether it has a future in Formula One or not.
Yeah, it's really a track that should be a mainstay on the calendar. As I understand it, Spa's keen to have a Grand Prix every year. And it's the one thing with the expansion. The expansion of F1 is good, and I've never been one to say that F1 should only be in the places where it's been massively popular for 50, 60, 70 years, or that got onto the Grand Prix racing train in the 1920s or something. But at the same time, you do need to make sure you keep that core as well. And Spa, you'd have to say, Ben, is... it's one of those two or three tracks that really is F1, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Silverstone's in there, Suzuka's in there. Spa is like absolutely one of the cathedrals of speed, to use an oft-repeated phrase. But also you've got the Verstappen factor. You know, he's Dutch, but he's got Belgian heritage too. There's a lot more interest in Formula One based around his success and his rise, and Spa should be able to capitalize on that. So it also seems strange to me from a commercial point of view that Formula One would doubt Spa's place, because in theory you've got the perfect mix. You've got, as I said before, a kind of slightly old school offering in terms of the fan experience, but that's good because you need a mix. You can't have, you know, only celebrity focused paddock club type Miami races, you need, and Vegas races, you need these kind of festival type camping races as well. You've got a great circuit. Okay, the climate can let you down as it did last year spectacularly, but it can also be fantastic. You've got a great circuit, you know, one of the few places where you can see Formula One cars working at their absolute best and their absolute limit. And then you've got a home driver at the absolute top of his game as a reigning world champion to support if you're a local fan from there or nearby country. So I don't see what there is not to like, really.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You've made a good case for it there. And we're also pretty close to the centenary for Spa as a Grand Prix venue. I think 1925 was its first Belgian Grand Prix. So all the more reason for it to stay on the calendar, although that could be a little bit of a battle for next year. Mark, we've talked a little bit about some of the factors that will contribute towards what we might see at the front this weekend. But heading into the Spa weekend, how do you think that Ferrari-Red Bull battle will pan out in terms of the pace balance of power?
Very, very close. I mean, it's always close. It's always been close in pretty much every race, but very balanced in its demands between those two cars. Spa's got a couple of sections favouring Red Bull's aero efficiency, and a big middle sector favouring Ferrari's downforce. That's, you know, just given the way that they normally set the cars up, the car's sweet spot for the Red Bull tends to be with a bit less downforce on it, but better aero efficiency, and the Ferrari's sweet spot tends to be with a bit more wing on it. And so that combination, you got sectors one and three add up to about the same time as you've spent in sector two. So it's very, very well balanced in theory, but I think probably a bigger factor than that will turn out to be, as it has often been this year, understanding the tyres, which Ferrari didn't get right last time out in Hungary. I think that's probably going to be the most important thing, especially with the cooler temperatures which are being forecast, which can make things a little bit tricky, and especially with such a long lap.
Yeah, and also the temperature could be quite fluctuating, couldn't it, given that although it can be very wet and cold there, it can also be quite hot still at this time of year. So you never know quite what you're shooting for when it comes to Spa. But an interesting one as well, Ben, because it's got that ideal overtaking element to it, doesn't it, with the run from the hairpin up to Les Combes. So it's one where you've got to have race pace as well as qualifying pace. So Ferrari, I guess, will be hoping that they've got that better balance, that they have achieved more as the season's gone on in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to be absolutely crucial. And I don't really have a lot of faith in them at the moment. You know, heading into this race, I feel like even if they do a reasonable job with the tyres and end up, you know, nicking pole again, which is very possible, I feel like, you know, the Red Bull's just going to zap past in the race at some point, inevitably. You know, we've seen in the past, you know, Lewis Hamilton doing some clever trickery on the throttle at the bottom of Eau Rouge to hold Sebastian Vettel behind and play with the gap so that the toe effect isn't so great when you get onto the straight afterwards. But I just feel like the way Red Bull are operating at the moment, how quick that car is in race trim and how good Verstappen is, even if he doesn't get pole, which he might do because he's a monster at Spa as well, he's just going to find a way by in the race. I suppose the only hope is maybe that, you know, as you mentioned, because the temperatures fluctuate, it might be quite cold, maybe that puts Red Bull out of the ideal window on the tyres. And you know, we saw in Austria how, you know, they can run into problems, particularly on the front, if things aren't quite right. But I think they're, as things stand, they are more likely to come away with a victory than Ferrari are.
Yeah, and how about Mercedes, Mark? Obviously, there's the big imponderable of the full impact of those changes that are being made in terms of the skids and the plank. But there has been this steady improvement for Mercedes. They're certainly looking pretty convincing now, and it feels like it's just a case of they need to just brute force development and develop quicker than those ahead if they want to get into that mix. So that's a test of how well they're going to work at a track like this that, as you said, is quite a nice little compromise between the first and third sectors and the more downforce dependent middle sector.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they approach their weekend, because it's natural formers that it's going to be hurt in those straight line sectors 1 and 3. But they, you know, how extreme do they dare go with low wing? Is there a way to sort of slot in and do an ideal little window? How does that dovetail in with the requirements of the tyres, which depends, you know, very, very much upon the weather. So they're not in charge of their own destiny, but it's not impossible that they find a little sweet spot with it.
Yeah, that's what they'll be working towards. And interesting as well to see how the battle between Russell and Hamilton goes there, because we've seen Hamilton's probably in the ascendancy recently, isn't he, Mark? He's been strongest. Yes, Russell got that pole in Hungary, but Hamilton did look quicker up until that DRS problem in qualifying. So there's quite a little interesting subplot there between those two drivers. It's very much spun around from where it was in the early stages of the season, and people were just deciding that Hamilton almost wasn't interested because things weren't going so well. We kind of shot down that notion earlier this year, but it has certainly changed as the season has got more together for Mercedes.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly close between them. The average over the where we can do like 9 races where we can do a proper comparison, and it's 200th of a second difference, which is by far the closest matchup of any teammate comparison. So it's tiny. Like, just one good weekend for one or the other of them will change the order. It's that close. As the car improves, and it does look to be on a good improvement curve now. It'll be especially interesting to see who can get the most from the improvement in the car, and whether there will even be a pattern or whether it'll continue just swinging backwards and forwards between them.
I think Russell probably fancies chances at Spa maybe as well. You know, he produced one of the qualifying laps of all time in the wet in that Williams. So I think he'll be confident heading into the weekend. Especially off the back of that qualifying performance in Hungary as well. So that is a really interesting subplot to me, actually, considering how close it is across the breadth of the season, but also because we're in a little run of circuits where not obviously Hamilton is good pretty much everywhere he goes, maybe save Austria, but that Russell also has shown particularly outstanding form in the past, and now he's got a much better car at his disposal to kind of underline, you know, the talent that he's got.
And that's another one of those little subplots that's very much feeding into next season, isn't it? I know with the championship being the status it is, you have to look at the second half of the season as partly being the preamble to next year as well. So those things will have an impact of how people are going into the winter and what footing they start next season on.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Well, Ben, Haas recently announced Antonio Giovinazzi. Remember him? We're driving FP1 at Monza and Cota. That's in addition to those mandatory two FP1 sessions that a rookie driver must run. Do you think that means he's a contender for a Haas seat in 2023? And what does that say about Mick Schumacher?
Oh, it has to be, doesn't he? I mean, why else would you do it when you've got these young driver rules to meet and you're not meeting by putting him in the car? I think it's been known for some time that kind of Mick Schumacher-Haas relationship isn't perhaps the most convivial or cordial. Some tensions behind the scenes there. You know, Mick was linked immediately with Sebastian Vettel's Aston Martin seat when he announced his shock retirement ahead of that race before Alonso steamed in and took a long-term contract up with that team. So that would suggest that Mick is looking for a way out, and it would also suggest if Giovinazzi jumping into the car that Haas are exploring their options. He's a kind of sensible guy to evaluate, I suppose, in the sense that they know him from the past. He's got experience. There aren't many plug-in and play options should you decide to mix up your driver lineup for next year at this stage, because so many guys are under contract, although obviously that's not stopping McLaren. And that is, you know, probably the best option. If I was Haas, I'd be tracking down Daniel Ricciardo's number and giving him a call and trying to get him in over Giovinazzi, to be perfectly frank. But if that's not possible, then, you know, he's probably one of the safest choices. So there's no harm in putting him in the car, seeing how he gets on now. And obviously it helps Ferrari because it's actual seat time for a guy who's sitting on the sidelines and hasn't driven a proper Formula One car for a while.
Yeah, well, the official reason they've given is that Ferrari want Giovinazzi to get some seat time in a 22 car because he is the reserve for Ferrari and Haas, in fact, when he hasn't been off wasting his time in a rather uncompetitive dragon ride in Formula E. What do you think, Mark? If you were Haas, would you be thinking, yeah, Giovinazzi's a better option than Schumacher?
I'd certainly be evaluating it, yes, because Mick hasn't made the case for himself. There's been flashes and he's certainly been more impressive in the latter few races than he was in the early season. But yeah, if the relationship's not working, I'd definitely be looking at Antonio. I think he'd be quite a good matchup with Kevin Magnussen, and he's already, you know, very you know, well integrated with the team. He knows the team. I think he's an obvious candidate if you're not going to continue with Mick, and Mick hasn't made the case for himself to be retained.
Yeah, and Giovinazzi has driven for Haas in Friday practice in 2017. He had a number of appearances in the second half of the year. He's an interesting driver, Giovinazzi. He is quick. There's a great story behind him because he's someone who didn't have a great deal of backing, certainly no real family backing financially for getting up the absurdly expensive junior ranks. So he made it to F1 on ability. He's been a little bit frustrating in F1 because he's quick, but a little bit erratic and doesn't always string it together. So I'm almost in two minds with Giovinazzi about whether is he just going to be the driver that's going to be a bit up and down and it'll be more of the same, or in a different environment to a slightly erratic Sauber team, could he actually really start stringing things together?
I think that's the crux of it. I mean, he is maybe slightly let down by Kimi Raikkonen in the sense that, you know, I think Giovinazzi got a bit comfortable being paired alongside Kimi and felt like he was doing a good job compared to him, and that was enough to prove that he was, you know, worthy of keeping around. But obviously the Kimi Raikkonen that he was up against was a pale imitation maybe of the Kimi Raikkonen that went just before, which was also a pale imitation of the Kimi Raikkonen that was the best version of himself in Formula One. So I think probably Giovinazzi hasn't quite been pushed hard enough. Now he's found himself turfed out. I think, you know, as Mark says, if he goes up against Kevin, who is rejuvenated since coming back to Formula One after being forced out for a time, you know, maybe that could have the same effect on Giovinazzi, and actually we might see him realise a bit more of his potential if he's up against another kind of youngish, hard charging driver rather than somebody who's way past his best and just kind of cashing in at the end of his career.
Yeah, and also for Giovinazzi, I guess he's had a year outside of Formula One, hasn't he, with a rather difficult year in Formula E. He didn't manage to score a point in rather limited machinery, it's fair to say. So sometimes drivers come back after a year out with a different perspective, and they've been able to think a little bit about their approach, et cetera, et cetera. But an interesting sort of situation. There's a few little driver market elements to be resolved. Obviously, the big thing is what's going on with Piastri and McLaren and Alpine, which we are expecting there to be some movement on imminently, but at the time of recording, nothing quite has happened. So it's all about who would get that Alpine seat, assuming Piastri's not going to be there, and it does seem like he definitely won't be there, given he's very much in with McLaren. But that means Alpine has a decision to make. Daniel Ricciardo seems to be the obvious choice, but then if they don't have Ricciardo, or Ricciardo doesn't want to go there, we don't really know exactly where his thinking is at the moment. I hope he goes there, but if not, then they need to look at some of these other possibilities. But you'd have to say, though, Mark, coming back to Mick Schumacher, it is an odd situation for him, because when things have come together, he has been strong. He was good in Austria, for example, qualified well and ran well early on in Canada before the reliability problems kicked in. So when things come together, it's there. But it's been up and down, but it's been more down than up so far this year, hasn't it?
Yeah, he was good at Silverstone too, and getting those first points. But just when he's made a breakthrough, you expect that. Think, right, okay, let's see if he can continue this run now. It's I see him fall away again, and there's not that evidence of inevitable progress that really we'd be looking to see for a driver in his second season. There's something not quite clicking there.
Yeah, and he'll be another driver to watch in the second half of that season for exactly that reason. And if the relationship with the team isn't great, and of course we should remember he was trying to see if there was a way out even for this year, which is no surprise given how much Haas was struggling last year, but he was possibly looking at whether he could get into the Alfa Romeo instead. So maybe some of it goes back to that, but he's certainly been expensive. But he is a driver who will have the upgrade package this weekend. He didn't have it in Hungary, just Kevin Magnussen had it. Haas said that the package worked well. Hungary wasn't a great track for them overall. Not especially optimistic about Spa or Monza because the car is a bit draggy, unfortunately, but they should have a package that can fight for points in the second half of the season. Well, thanks very much, Ben and Mark, for this quick look ahead to the resumption of the F1 season at Spa. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen for all the coverage you need from the second half of the F1 season. And make sure you check out our YouTube channel and our sister podcasts, including Bring Back V10s. And also check out our live hub during the weekend. You can follow the action over the Belgian Grand Prix weekend. You can also fire in questions to us at The Race. So if you want to ask myself or Mark or Ben or Gary Anderson or whoever happens to be around a question or two, we will endeavour to answer them. So we are off to Spa now. So stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.